suppose we can go ahead and get started. And as other people come in, they can join us. I'm a medical doctor, and I specialized into obstetrics, or pregnancies, delivering babies, and gynecology, which is the diseases and conditions of women's reproductive systems. But I'd like to put aside my specialty and talk to you more as a doctor, and more perhaps in the line of being a consumer advocate in an educated way, and perhaps pose some new ideas for you. And sometimes these may be controversial, and that's okay. That's great if it gets us thinking and talking together. A couple of things I'd like to start out with. One is a quote by Albert Schweitzer that I found, and it's he said that it's supposed to be a professional secret, but I'll tell you anyway. We doctors do nothing. We only help and encourage the doctor within. The second comes from the first book I have up there on the board, which I got for Christmas and just got around to reading when I got up to Holden, and am very excited about. This talks about degenerative disease and regenerative action as it speaks to being a health activist. It's talking about an attitude. The attitude is a kind of national hypochondria, which for many people amounts to a virtual lack of confidence in our basic biologic form. This attitude is characterized by excessive worrying about personal health, by numerous trips to a variety of doctors, by a feeling, even in outwardly healthy people, that the body is either hiding a secret, a malicious disease, or simply falling apart. With that as a takeoff point, I'd like to talk about wellness. This is an idea that you may have heard some people discuss and may not have. It's fairly new in medicine. There are just now beginning to get to be what are called wellness doctors. They also take care of your illnesses, but their focus is your wellness, and that's different than anything traditional medicine has ever done. And I'd like to tell you start and tell you a little bit about what you can do in terms of your own wellness that will help me as a physician give you more information when you need it, tell you where you can get information, tell you where you can find ways or methods to change some aspect of your lifestyle that you would like to change, that you feel will make you healthier. And the first of this is a personal health history. And I have a lot of friends in Salem, where I come from, that are internists. And if you go to see an internist and you've never seen him before, he usually hands you a mimeograph type of paper that's now they're put out by companies. They cost a fair amount of money. And what it does is it asks you to record your own health history on it. And it gives you the format for doing that. And then it has three pages of questions that are designed to find out, you know, whether you hear all right and whether you see all right or have had any problems with that. Do you wear glasses? Checks out your heart symptoms, lung symptoms, stomach and bowel symptoms, bladder symptoms, kidney symptoms, arthritis symptoms, bone symptoms. And you can tell that there are some 200 odd questions in that. It takes a little while to go through, but in addition, then he will go over that with you verbally, and that takes about an hour. I think that it can be done in less time, and you can begin to keep some of this yourself. What you need to do is you need to have a written record of your immunizations. If you've ever had a TB skin test, you'd like to know when that was. If you've had x-rays done, what were the x-rays? When were they done, and what did they show? What about electrocardiograms or EKGs, pap smears, dental checks? You need to have a list of the doctors that you've seen. I saw just before I left a lady in my office who had some kind of pelvic surgery. She didn't remember what, and it was done by a doctor who she didn't remember, and it was done within the last 18 months. Very difficult for me then to help her because I didn't know what was done and I didn't know where to go to find out what was done because she couldn't help at all. So it's a nice thing to have in your health book for yourself a little part of your, make it a loose leaf notebook. Put some of those dividers like we used in high school in it and put one of the doctors I have seen and the dates that you saw them. Then you've got his name and his address. When you need records, you can get records. What did he see you for? What kind of information were you given? Not only what was your diagnosis with what you went in with what was wrong, what did you learn from the doctor that visit? I'm firmly convinced that one of the ways you get your money's worth out of medicine is that if you come in to see me and I tell you you have a cold and you don't find out something else besides that you have a cold, if you don't find out some other piece of health information, that you're kind of not getting what you could. And so that's another thing. Some question that you've had that you can find out about that same visit. Then a record of your own health. Any illnesses that you've had, serious illnesses, whether you were treated out at home, seeing the doctor in his office, or whether you were hospitalized. What was the nature of that illness? Was a diagnosis made? What kind of treatment were you given? What are the names of the drugs? It's always helpful for you to know that. If you had surgery, what was done and why was it done? That's really important for you to know and for you to be able to tell another doctor. The other thing is there are a lot of what we call non-traditional therapies going on. There's an increase in chiropractors, in naturopaths, in lay health workers, in nurse practitioners and physician's assistants, in acupuncture clinics, stress reduction clinics, stress reduction workshops. All of these are what I would put into a great big lump of non-traditional therapies. They have a place that organized medicine is not quite sure what to do with, so a lot of organized medicine doesn't know what to say about it. Traditionally, there is the conflict between a chiropractic school of thought and the medical school of thought, and yet there's beginning to exist some questions in some of the MDs that I know of that maybe the chiropractors do a pretty good job with what they do. So that, you know, we want to look at that. And I think that, again, I'm beginning to use a method of measuring that or of judging that is, does the patient feel better after the encounter, and do the symptoms go away? That's how I judge things in medicine, and I would judge chiropractic by the same way. A lot of scientific study needs to go into some of the non-traditional therapies, though, before we can come with as much surety as we can say that if penicillin is for a strep throat and take it for 10 days and we know what that's going to do and we can tell you what's going to happen if you don't and your statistical likelihood of what's going to happen to you. We'd like to get that information about a lot more of our therapies. The two biggies that I see right now that I gave up on about, 10 years ago when I was in medicine was stop smoking and lose weight. Those two things, if we could do that, we'd probably, you know, help people do that. We'd probably increase the general level of health in America tremendously, because those are the two biggest things right now that we deal with in a negative way about our health. Family history. You need to know, you know, did Grandma die of a heart attack or did she have a stroke? Who had high blood pressure in the family anymore? For a lot of the men and some of the women coming up now, with our high blood pressure, we're not going to get our heart attack because we're going to get a coronary bypass before we get to the point where we have the heart attack. That kind of thing would be nice to know if Dad's just had his triple coronary bypass. Anybody with cancer, anybody with diabetes mellitus or sugar in the urine, anybody with glaucoma, which is where the blood pressure in your eye builds up too high and you have to have surgery or go on medications, anybody with nervous or mental disorders, alcoholism, these kinds of things. These should be in your personal health history. And you can, the next time you get together with mom or dad, or your cousins, or this, you begin to find out, you know, what happened to old Uncle Joe? You know, what did he die of? These things can be helpful in terms of some of the diseases and illnesses that strike us that are partially hereditary. You'd like to know what drugs you've taken, and I talked a little bit about that. Allergies is another subject, and it's a terribly confusing area. But if you have hay fever, if you get rashes to certain things, chemicals, cosmetics, fabrics, foods, and of course in terms of the medical doctor, drugs. If you've had a reaction to a drug, what was that reaction? I all the time have people tell me they're allergic to codeine. And the reason they say they're allergic to codeine is because they get nauseated when they take codeine. Well, that's a side effect of codeine. And codeine is a very, very irritant substance to the tummy. So nausea is not uncommon at all, and it's not an allergy. An allergy usually is itchy eyes, runny nose, difficulty breathing maybe, if it's severe enough, real difficulty breathing. And they can be life-threatening. Then in the wellness bag, look at your health habits. Heart disease and high blood pressure account for more than 50% of all deaths in the United States. That's pretty significant. When you look at heart disease and high blood pressure, you kind of have to begin to talk about some of the things that also impact into those two areas, and your coffee intake does. Your cholesterol level does. Your weight does. Cigarettes. Exercise. And I'll get back to some of those things in just a little bit. But those are some of the things that you need to take an assessment of in your own life. Maybe I'll talk just a little bit about that now. I get into it with some of the diet stuff and exercise stuff. I think will be the best place to do that. There were a couple of questions, and I found them interesting for me and somewhat enlightening. I don't say these things to embarrass people, although we all have that little voice in our head which says, oh, you shouldn't be doing that. If I say that it's a health habit which is a negative one, what I'd like to point out is I am a cigarette smoker, and I haven't smoked a cigarette in 2 years. I used to smoke over 2 packs a day, and I smoked for 18 years. About 3 or 4 years ago, if I had to stop smoking cigarettes, I probably would have had a nervous breakdown. In other words, I have that habit because I needed it, and it provided something for me that was important. And until I can find a way to supplant that, okay, with something that's more healthy for me that I choose, then giving it up does constitute a health hazard just as much as keeping it. So the balance there is what's important. And the important thing for people to understand is that, you know, if we can help them to arrive at increased awareness, increased tools for their health, then that's what medicine is all about. It's a partnership. It's not saying that. Okay. Some of the things in this health questionnaire, and I'll run through some of them just quickly. Do you add sugar to your beverages? Add salt to your food? Do you skip breakfast? Eat on the run or gulp down meals? Crave salts? Crave sweets? Eat red meat every day? Get less than 6 hours of sleep per night? Regularly drink soft drinks or pop? Forget to floss your teeth, brush your teeth once or less a day, not get enough exercise, not warm up prior to vigorous exercise, Non-smokers, do you allow others to smoke in your home? Do you not have the phone number of the nearest fire department, police department, physician, and hospital within easy reach? Do you collect outdated medications in a medicine cabinet? Do you use a non-biodegradable or phosphate-containing detergent? Do you forget to shut off lights or appliances? Rely on air conditioning? Not own a bicycle? Have an automobile which gets fewer than 18 miles to the gallon? Do you allow more than 1 year to elapse between pap tests for women? Women, do you not know how to do a breast self-examination? Men over 45, do you not get a prostate and rectal exam yearly? Do you never question your doctor? Do you believe that an annual physical is all that you need to determine your state of health? Rely on the salesperson in the health food store for medical advice? On the job, do you have only fluorescent lights in your work area? Do you work around cigarette smokers? Do you depend on cafeteria or vending machines for work time meals and snacks? Get caught in rush hour traffic? Sit in a chair without good back support? Work long hours at a time without mini breaks? These are some of the things that are in this health questionnaire, and I found it just flooring. I scored myself reasonably low on this because of a lot of my health habits. And the interesting thing about this is, he says, is, you know, take this and, you know, be aware of what your results are. And pick what you want to do different, you know, and don't try and move the mountain, okay? It's okay to pick up one rock at a time. For most of us, it took us a good many years to get to where we are now, and it takes a fairly significant amount of time to change and stop doing what we're doing now. And the reason is because most of these are lifestyle changes, and I was very interested. John Schramm has a session, I think, tomorrow on the first step in lifestyle change. And I'll talk a little bit about stress. And the first step in your lifestyle change is a stressor, okay? And so if you do that and you know you're going to do that, you can count that you're going to be under more stress, and you're going to need to take some other steps to help reduce that stress for yourself, cope with that stress. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. Let me go through nutrition just real quick. There's a lot that's been out about this, and I've got a whole list of questions about food that's kind of like this other one. But if you want that, that's in this book here listed at the top. And if you want, I'll put these on a piece of paper and put them over on the bulletin board, because it's kind of hard to write them all down. One of the things that's kind of fun to do to check out your own diet is to keep a week's listing of your diet. You're not to change your diet, you're not to modify it in any way. You put down what you eat, not necessarily 2 cups full of green beans or whatever you may eat, but just about what you eat and whether you snack and whether or not there are do you snack because you feel a craving for something, okay? And then you review that over the next, after you've kept it for a week, put it in a drawer for a week, and then go back and look at it just to see what you eat. And you may find a lot of surprises there. A lot of people do. And then you can say, well, gee, I don't want to do that anymore, or I'm going to change that. That's not very neat. Other things. Fiber in the diet avoids constipation and bowel problems. Very interesting at Holden and that the whole grain cereals tend to do this. The processed grains or refined grains remove the hull, and that not only removes a lot of the fiber, but it removes the B vitamins, some E and C, and some of the trace minerals too. So that, in a sense, with the increase in our technology, there's been a decrease in our nutrition or potential nutrition. We can talk about eggs. There's some new stuff coming out that came out of the University of Washington not too long ago that said one egg a day isn't bad for you. It doesn't change your cholesterol level at all. But I think more work needs to be done on that before you take it, and you need to talk with your doctor about that if you're on a cholesterol-restricted diet. It's not a bad idea for the rest of us to decrease the amount of cholesterol that we eat. milk. We're finding out that there are a lot of people with intolerance to milk. They cannot digest lactose. And that results in some problem. And I have a few people that I know that every time they have milk, or if they eat something with milk in it, they get just a terrible diarrhea. And it's a very interesting thing to see more and more of this happening in our population. And so meat, poultry, and fish, there's been a lot said about this. And again, I would support where Holden is in this. The red meats, almost all of these are raised in feedlots now. With the crowded conditions in feedlots, it has become necessary to feed the animals antibiotics in order that there doesn't get to be widespread disease among the animals. Well, traces of the antibiotics remain in the meat. And while that may not be bad for you, it may not be good for you. And there's been a lot of question raised with the use of hormones in raising poultry and red meat animals in order to make them bigger and fatter and weigh more. And of course, I think that probably is not, in the long run, healthy. And it's not that I can point to any one of these things and says, aha, this causes such and such, you know. What I can say is it may not cause anything, but when you take a lot of those little teeny tiny things and you put them all together in your life for 45 years, Lord knows what they're going to cause. They're probably not healthy for us in the amounts that we may consume them over that period of time. Beans and nuts are supposed to be good. I don't know very much. I'm not a bean connoisseur. As I read about nutrition, I'm told that there needs to be a wide variety of beans because each one differs a little bit in its nutritive value. They did say that the beans don't cause flatulence. Now, that's a great big medical word, but it's kind of fun to say, briefly translated, it's gas. And they say that if beans are eaten in a variety and they're cooked right, that you don't have a problem with gas. Cooked right means they should be able to be mashed with your tongue against the roof of your mouth. They also say that eating beans increases whatever enzymes you need to digest beans, and you don't get the gas problem. So maybe if we switch over a little bit and learn more about it, we won't have to regret what we've eaten. Okay, going to talk a little bit about sugar. We get a lot of sugar. We get an awful lot of sugar. And it's been estimated that Americans per year consume 125 pounds of processed or, quotes, simple sugar. Just in case you're wondering what your average consumption of soft drinks is, it's 221 cans of soft drinks per year for the average American. That's an awful lot of pop and sugar. And just in case, let's see, just in case that you think that the list ends there, shake and bake is 51% sugar. Okay? Russian dressing, 30% sugar. Jell-O, 83% sugar. Okay. I mean, we get it. We get it without even knowing we're getting it. Okay. In my family, we kind of noticed about 3 or 4 years ago that when we had a sugar dessert at dinner time, or if my son happened to get a hold of pop or a sugary candy bar, that kind of thing after dinner, that it was just like somebody blew up one of these great big balloons and then let it go. And that was kind of his over the place, and we couldn't calm him down. You know, it was 10, 11 o'clock before he was going to bed. And I think this talks and speaks to some of the stuff that begins to happen and we begin to see. I see people in my office all the time that say, you know, I'm great when I get up in the morning, and then about 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, I just run out of gas. I just am low, dragging. I feel like I want to go to sleep. You know, it's very simple. I say, well, what do you eat for breakfast? Well, I have a piece of toast and some jelly and some cereal. Well, how much sugar do you put on? A couple of teaspoons of sugar and a glass of juice and coffee. And right there, I know why she feels tired. And that's because that she's got the sugar blues. And when you dump sugar into your system, what happens is the blood sugar goes sailing out of sight. And you got an organ inside the middle of your tummy right about here called your pancreas. And it makes something called insulin that allows your body to use sugar. Well, when it goes sailing out of sight, the insulin says, boy, I got to get busy. So the pancreas goes squeeze and the insulin goes into the system and the blood sugar starts going down. But the problem is it overcompensates and it sails down low. And there's your sugar blues, and you get a craving for sugar, and sugar solves the problem. And so you eat some sugar. I mean, that's what's most readily available in people's job, in people's home, as a snack food, is something that's sugar. And you feel great, but then you don't have an appetite for lunch. So about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, what happens? Back down goes the blood sugar, and you eat some more sweets. And it happens again about 4 or 5. One of the ways to get around this is to have a breakfast with protein, primarily protein in the morning. And if you do that, then you begin to avoid that wide fluctuation, the high blood sugar, the low blood sugar. And it's like being on a seesaw when you get there, and it really takes a lot to get off. And it will take you some time to get out of the habit of what you eat for breakfast. It does me. You know, I still sail on the sugar roller coaster every now and then. And so that change occurs slowly, but I want to bring it up and I want to point it out. This, we think, also contributes to the onset of what we call adult onset diabetes. That means that when you get to be somewhere between 35 and 55, you become diabetic. And diabetic means that you've worn out your pancreas. It does not produce the insulin you need to keep the sugar moving. And so what happens is your blood sugar goes way, 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 way up. You're all prone to a lot more diseases and illnesses. Your risk of strokes, heart attacks goes out of sight again. It increases markedly. And we think that a good part of this may be simply how we consume sugars. So this is one thing that we can begin to look at. It's a long-term change. Really hard with kids in the house, you know. We've got a 13-year-old daughter who now can go down to the store by herself, and you know what she buys. Comes back with these bags of candy. Watch Dad go through the roof there. Salt. Let's talk a little bit about salt, because anybody who's been to the doctor and he says your blood pressure's a little bit up, and you ought to stop eating salt. Well, if you don't add any salt to your food, you simply cook with the salt that you're supposed to in the recipes, but you add no other salt and you stay away from high salt containing foods, then you probably get about 3 to 5 grams of salt a day. And that's what you need. The average salt intake for the average American is between 8 and 20 grams of salt per day. And for me growing up in my house, that's a bad news thing. My son's following in my own footsteps. He just turns it upside down and goes around the plate a few times and puts it down. And we have a little food with our salt. All righty, let's talk about beverages. The best beverage is water. And I see women, and I see lots of women with urinary tract infections, and I say, you need to drink more fluids. And the answer almost universally is, I can't stand water. And it's interesting, as I talk to the women that don't have urinary tract infections, they don't mind drinking water. So I'm beginning to draw something in my own little head. Maybe people who grow up thinking that water's a lousy drink, you know, are the ones that we see continually with urinary tract infections. A word about coffee. Coffee contains some 50 alkaloids. These are what give it its taste and aroma and why we like it. It also contains caffeine, and the average cup of coffee contains 100 milligrams of caffeine in the cup. Black tea, commercial black teas, also contain caffeine. If you get 250 milligrams, that's a little better than 2.5 cups of coffee, you'll raise your adrenaline level 200%.
Now, that's what people mean when they say coffee hypes them up. Okay? It also wrings you dry. And we see people come into the office with, I'm so rubbed down and pooped out. I'm fatigued all the time and I can't understand it. I drink 10 cups of coffee a day. You know, but they've just wrung themselves out, and it's going to take them a while to recover from that. And it also, there is a very definite caffeine withdrawal symptoms. You can get the most splitting headache if you've been drinking even just 4 cups of coffee a day and you go to no coffee a day. You can just bust your head right open with a headache. It just is incredible. And you go and you take an aspirin. What's aspirin? Aspirin is a combination of what's truly aspirin, a compound called phenacetin, which in large enough amounts will poison your kidneys, and caffeine. Okay? And so you take one aspirin or two aspirin, you've got enough caffeine to go in 2 cups of coffee, and zip, your headache's gone. And so you say, aspirin took my headache away. Not realizing that what you've done is given yourself the caffeine to get rid of your caffeine and withdrawal headache. I was just looking up here. It says a 3-log limit. If I pass my 3-log limit, please let me know. Fitness. Physical fitness is an area that's interesting. It's also one that most people, when they think about physical fitness, think of getting up a half an hour earlier in the morning and doing calisthenics in their bedroom with their spouse or roommate laughing. I'm going, ah, 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 ah. I know one person that does yoga, and they won't allow anybody in the room when they do yoga. What we're talking about in terms of fitness and what we find really helps in terms of your heart and your lungs and the miles of piping that you have to run the blood around your body is that you need to raise your heart rate to approximately 150 for 5 minutes and do that 2 to 5 times a day. Well, that's a bummer if you've never done any exercise. Okay? And I think that unless you get an okay from your doctor, if you're not into an exercise program, that you may be putting yourself at risk. So what you need to do is to check in with your doctor and find out if it's okay if you go ahead and get into some kind of a graduated exercise program. And for those of you who don't like sports, jogging, swimming, a brisk walk is a great way to do that. Just a good, comfortably paced walk. If you begin to get short of breath or you begin to feel like your heart's pounding, slow down, stop, rest. And pay attention to your body, because your body's going to be something that you can learn to trust, and it will give you valid information. You may need help in terms of the knowledge about your body. You may need help in terms of interpreting some of those things sometimes, and that's where the doctor comes in. But you can trust your body. Stretching is good. Stretching is designed to loosen muscles, and it's a really neat tension reliever. Stretching isn't done by bending over and bouncing down to bounce yourself down to get to your toes. What really happens when you do that is you tighten up your muscle rather than loosen up your muscle. And that's an important thing to know. Stretch is usually just allowing yourself, you know, I'm stretching my arm right now because I'm reaching for that wall. And it's important to remember to breathe. Most of us, when we make an effort of some kind, hold our breath. And breathing is part of stretching and allowing things to relax. The next area is stress management. And I don't know if you've been into stress management stuff at all, you're probably sick and tired of it by now. But it's vital. It's necessary for us. And most of us have not been taught anything about how to either assess the amount of stress we're under or to pay attention to the amount of stress that we're under on a day-to-day basis, and to be willing then to modify our activity. There's a person in the southern part of Oregon by the name of Jack Schwartz, and Jack Schwartz talks about internal control of things that doctors didn't believe could be controlled, huh? Know-it-alls. But Jack has, over a number of years, trained himself to control his internal processes. He can control his heart rate. He can control his body temperature. He can control whether he bleeds or not bleeds, whether he feels pain or does not feel pain, how fast he heals. He can control whether he sweats or doesn't sweat. And I don't think there's one of us in the room that could say that. He has gotten hooked up to something like a polygraph. That's what they put people on to do lie detector tests. It measures the skin resistance, which is an electrical phenomenon. It measures temperature, perspiration or moisture, measures heart rate, respiration, brain waves, the whole bit. And then he takes and puts a needle through his forearm, in one side, out the other side. And when he is controlling his internal process, nothing changes. He takes the needle out, and he doesn't bleed. And he heals within a week, and he doesn't get infected. And I don't at all suggest that we be like him. Okay? What I can tell you is that we are finding out that we can teach people who have migraine headaches how not to have migraine headaches. We can teach people who have high blood pressure how to lower their blood pressure by what they do in their head. Okay? There is also some very, very, very exciting stuff going on with people with terminal cancer who medicine's done, you know, everything that we could, and now we can't do any more. And they've gotten into a program, University of Chicago, where they have taught these patients a technique called imaging, and that's to have an image of their cancer and then to do something to erase that image. Take a pencil eraser in your mind and begin to erase on it. And they have measured the size of the tumor mass that these people have and shown with objective measurements that the tumor mass decreases in size. Okay? Really exciting kinds of things.
Well, let's see. What can I tell you about stress? Stress was originally a lifesaver for us. What happened to our ancestors way back when the saber-toothed tiger jumped off the rock, going rawr, you know, was that they had a stress reaction. And that basically is a fight or flight reaction. And that means that you mobilize all your defenses, the blood vessels that go to your abdomen decrease so that the blood can't circulate through there. The blood vessels going to your muscles increase. Your pupils dilate. You breathe more deeply and more rapidly. You're queued up. Well, that was great for him because he needed to beat feet like fast because the tiger was going to get him. Well, we've got lots of tigers in our world today. They don't look like tigers. But they're there, and they cause that same kind of reaction. And they may not cause it to the same degree, and they're all degrees of that reaction. But it's there for us. And we say, well, how much stress is too much? Well, in addition to the quantity of stress, we're talking about what we do with the stress inside of our own bodies. I have some pretty good stress monitors for me. I get a pain right here in the back of my shoulder when I start getting under too much stress, and that's, I know right away what's happened. And so then I can begin to change some things in my day so that I manage the stress that I have, because I don't see that I'm going to change the stress that I have during the day particularly very much, but I can change what I do with it. And that's the important thing, the learning edge that I'm on and that I invite you to be on also. And so your body is your stress meter. And each one of us, as we become aware of stress, and you know, obviously it takes it from what happened when you got in the automobile accident when your knees turned weak as water, you know, after that. You could hardly stand up. Well, that's one way of measuring stress, and your body's telling you that. You know, that says, hey, you've had too much stress. You better sit down. Okay. Well, you start with that kind of stress, and you work back with smaller stressors. And pretty soon you've got a finely tuned instrument that will pick that up. No doctor can do that for you. No doctor can. But you can do it for yourself. Okay. The letting go, and that's what I mean with what you do with it. How do you cope with it? Well, it would be neat sometimes in my office to have a room that was soundproof. And I could go into it and I could just... Would that be one way to let go? Some people let go by crying. Okay. When my nurse gets under too much stress, she comes into my office, we close the door, she sits down and cries. You know? Then she feels better. Okay. Some people that I know run as a way of taking care of that. Some people do yoga. Some people go get massagers. All sorts of ways. And you find your own. You find the things that work for you, that feel good. And that's how you know. All righty. To illustrate that, I want to use a story that's in this book. That's kind of fun because it's something that I see frequently. It was about a woman, and therefore I identified with it because primarily what I see is women. When I see a man in my office, I either assume he's the father of a baby or one of my pregnant ladies, or that he's gotten in the wrong place. When they find out what part of my building that they're in, they often leave in a hurry. Okay, once upon a time, there lived in the Pacific Northwest an attractive young woman who had everything she needed. An interesting job, sufficient income, plenty of friends, a good set of cross-country skis. She also had one thing that she didn't need, fainting spells. The spells began during the time that she was pressing for a promotion with the newspaper where she worked. After fainting into the arms of her cigar-smoking editor, she consulted her doctor. Okay. She took the prescribed drugs, and although they brought some relief, she still would often feel dizzy and lightheaded. She began to go from doctor to doctor, having her blood analyzed, her skull x-rayed, her eyes tested, her brainwaves charted. Through several minor abnormalities were discovered, no treatment was able to halt the continued reoccurrence of her symptoms. Finally, in desperation, she asked her editor if he knew of any good doctors. "There is only one left who could do any good at all," he chomped. "You must go see Dr. Harry. And she did. She found Dr. Harry lounging in a hammock beside a lake in rural Oregon. "Doctor," she began. "Call me Harry," he interrupted. "Tell me what I need to know in order to help you." "Harry, these fainting spells are driving me absolutely mild. Mad, I'm sorry." Got down to the next one. "I'm disintegrating. I've got a million things going right now, and I can't do any of them. I'm always late. I'm overcommitted. I've got loose ends everywhere I look. I toss and turn all night. And all this is really started about the same time as my fainting spells. I've been to doctor after doctor with little luck. You are my last hope. What's wrong with her?" The eminent doctor puffed on his pipe, looked out over his glasses. "My dear young lady, what we have here is yet another case of the frenzied mind. The effects you listed as being the result of your spells are really the cause. You have whipped your mind into such a fury that the body's only hope was to attempt to draw in the reins by fainting. Yes, stress is the real culprit, or more specifically, your tendency to respond to stress by accelerating the rate of your mental activity." Fifth case of frenzied mind I've seen this week. "That's all well and good, Harry," our young woman replied, "but what am I supposed to do about it?" "Well,
There's yoga, autogenic training, biofeedback, psychological counseling, visualization techniques, color therapy, gestalt training, creative movements, soap in the hot springs. Dr. Payson's voice continued to drone on. He spoke with the voice of a priest chanting a litany of the saints. He seemed to be in a kind of trance. Dance therapy, patterning, massage, jogging, long walks on the beach, prayer, frisbee throwing. Somewhere between the 30th and 35th option, our young woman began to feel a certain peace settle into her being. She rose and headed up the narrow path to her car. Well, that's I think, not only what a lot of us is in medicine are seeing in our offices these days. We don't feel sometimes the freedom to have 30 to 35 options on what to do about it, especially when those options are non-medical therapies, and especially when there is some paranoia on the part of medical personnel about missing something, okay? And that I think is a real problem, and I don't know how to do that except, as my patient says, I'm willing to assume some of the responsibility for this myself, okay? And I can tell the patient, I think you've got a 1 in 25,000 chance that there's something wrong with you. Otherwise, I think it's probably a stress reaction. Do you want me to go through and do all of the medical workup, which will run somewhere in the realm of $350 to $500? And then the patient can begin to make some decisions with that, too. I do have some patients who say, well, you decide.
Which really drives me out of my tree, but
okay. There's one last thing that needs to go into your, if you will, your wellness bag. A wellness bag is a, I take that from Whole Person Healthcare. A wellness bag is a recycled brown shopping bag that you can decorate any way you want. And into that you put your health history, and you put your assessment of your nutrition, and your assessment of your activity level, exercise level, and you put into that, what you think of your stress management, how do you manage stress, are there any areas that you want help with or change with. And the last thing that needs to go in is the wellness glue, and you get that at Holden. And that's your God-given gift to relish, taste, and enjoy your life. With all of what we're talking about, there's a tendency, at least on my part, to begin to say, as soon as I can manage my stress better, then I can enjoy. As soon as I change my diet and make it more healthy, then I can enjoy. And what happens is I get into a waiting pattern, and I don't enjoy life. I'm always working at this and beating myself for that. And I think that's what I'm talking about is the wellness glue, is to accept yourself and say there are things I'd like to change, and I'll do that at my own speed, and I'll change them as rapidly as I can. And in the meantime, I'm really going to enjoy what I'm doing. And that's necessary. And if you don't do that, you probably get sick. Okay. I haven't left as much time as I wanted for thing. I do want to say just a word about self-care, and I've put up three books here. These last three books are all about self-care, and I think that's a coming thing. It's a necessary thing. It used to be provided by your grandmother, and if you live way out in the middle of the Ozark Mountains in the Adirondacks, you can still find people who will provide that care for you. It's good care. When it's coupled with being terribly far away from a doctor, I think it can be dangerous because you may know that you need a doctor and not be able to get there. But for the most part, you can take care of 90% of what I see in my office in your own home. Okay? There are two things that are going to stop you from doing that. And basically, they're both the lack of your own self-confidence. The two things that you need then are you need some knowledge and some skills and some training in health. And fortunately, there are more and more places able to provide this. More and more doctor's offices, maybe not your doctor himself, but his receptionist or his nurse can also provide that kind of information for you. My nurse taught three people how to read a thermometer the last week before I came up here. I mean, these were mothers with small children who did not know how to read a thermometer. Okay, so that's what we're talking about, skills, knowledge. Okay, and then the second thing is a belief that's widely held and that's somewhat frustrating to deal with as a healthcare provider, and that is that our healthcare is done to us or for us rather than by us. Some of the interesting things about this are that 40 the studies that have been done by some of the universities show that patients who receive medications at a doctor's office, only 45% of them take them in the manner directed by the doctor. It means 55% don't take them that way. And the same thing's true when they said, well, are you doing what your doctor asked you to do? Only about 45% of them are doing what the doctor said to do. And so that's part of illustrating that I can do everything that I can do, and if you're not my partner and if you're not helping me, we do nothing. And that's very expensive care when you think about it that way. Well, let me tell you a little bit about getting the most out of your doctor. And some doctors are going to get their bristles up about this, and some doctors won't. I think that to begin with, the doctor-patient relationship is the only and the primary way of measuring healthcare. If you don't trust me enough to tell me what's on your mind, whether that's good or bad, whether you're angry at me, whether you're sad about something, whether I've let you down in some way, or please, I need them when I've done good with you, then our relationship suffers and I cannot provide good healthcare for you. If I don't know, for instance, that you're coming to see me and you've had your brother die last month, your husband just went up to one of the big medical centers to have a triple coronary artery bypass done, and you're babysitting for the three grandchildren because your daughter just got the flu, you know, and you're coming in to see me about something, I may prescribe a treatment for you that's totally out in the blue, that you couldn't possibly do. On the other hand, if I know those kinds of things, which only you can tell me, I may be able to not only give you a more reasonable treatment for some condition that you may have, I may be able to actually tell you where you can tap into community resources, which will make your job a lot easier. If you can't talk to your doctor, or you feel you can't, then what I would do would be to recommend that you make an appointment to go in and see your doctor and say, doctor, I don't feel I can talk to you and I'd like to talk to you about that problem. Or I'd find another doctor that you can talk to. And that's important. Okay, let's talk about some of the things that have been going on that I think you need to do with your doctor when you go in to see him. First off, there's the question of unnecessary surgery. I'd like you to know that I'm a surgeon and that I happen to be in a specialty that does the most unnecessary surgery of any profession in the medical profession, and that's a gynecologist, and I take out uteruses. I think sometimes I'm still a little thin-skinned about that. Most of my skin has gotten thickened and armor-planked over the last year or so. But I have patients occasionally who say, well, you may be right, doc, but I'd like to find out what somebody else thinks. And I then give that patient five names of five people that I think practice a high level of gynecology in the community, or an alternative of referring them to one of the staff people at the University of Oregon in Portland for a second opinion. And sometimes my ego gets involved in that, and unfortunately that is partly my patient problem. Mostly it's my problem. It distresses me probably more than it distresses my patient when my ego's involved. But at no time will I refuse a patient a second opinion about either a diagnosis or a potential surgical procedure, and I think you ought to feel free to to ask your doctor, would you recommend several doctors that I might get a second opinion from when it's non-emergency surgery?
I don't know what necessary surgery is, by the way. I define for myself necessary surgery as any surgery which is mandatory to save a life, and that boils it down to a few things like appendectomies, ectopic or tubal pregnancies will kill a woman if they're not operated on. We'll lose a baby sometimes if we don't do a cesarean section. Those, I would say, are necessary surgeries. The rest are surgeries which may enhance the quality of life, but don't either provide life or death situation. So I think that's a fuzzy area. I think we're going to have a lot of trouble. And I can't decide sometimes on those things whether it's necessary. So I go to my patient and I say, is this necessary for you? And she says, yes. I'm likely to take her word if I agree that surgery is going to help her. If I think surgery won't help her, then I'm going to tell her that too. Ask that your doctor tell you all of the treatment or therapy options and their risks and benefits. One of the conditions that I see fairly frequently is called endometriosis, and I'll tell you what that is if you need to know in a subsequent question. There are four things to do with endometriosis. And anytime I make that diagnosis on a patient, I tell them the four things, and I tell them what I think is going to be best for them, and I tell them what, if you were my wife or my daughter, what I would think you probably ought to do. And then answer their questions and then say, well, you know, if you can make a decision now, fine. And if you can't, you can think about it, ask more questions, and come back and see me in a week and we'll talk more about it. Now, some of these things, you just can't make a decision like that. Make sure you understand the words your doctor uses. Now, I can talk medicalese pretty easily. It's what I talk with my colleagues all the time. And since that's my primary language, I sometimes forget that you don't know what endometrium is. And so I may say, well, I just need to sample your endometrium.
My what?
So I need to talk in words that you people understand, and sometimes I make some assumptions that are wrong. I assume that because you're a nurse or because you work down at the charity clinic, that you know some medical terms that you don't know. And so you need to tell me when that is happening as a doctor. Because I don't mind at all. I go back and explain it to you. Okay, I've got a little bit more on facilitating a visit to the doctor. I'd like to leave that and I'll come back to it. I want to talk about costs of medicine, which I promised that I would. I want you to know that being in the practice of medicine is a business. That's how I make my living. And some people, I think, feel that living is a little bit too luxurious. I want to also tell you that I am an extremely poor businessman. Okay? I went through high school, and in seventh grade, my algebra teacher told my mother that I would never graduate from high school. I do not like math. I have a heck of a time balancing our checkbook. As a matter of fact, I leave that to my wife because I have given up some 12 years ago. So many of you in the room, many of you in the room are probably better businessmen than I am. And if I'm doing, or if I say something that doesn't make good sense as a businessman, then raise your hand and correct me, because I'm learning about being a businessman. I know about being a doctor. Okay, well, hospital costs. Let's start there because that's the least threatening to me. You better believe they're high. They're sky high and out of sight and unaffordable even to the upper middle class population who makes a good income if he's paying out of his own pocket and somebody happens to get bad sick. Insurance really isn't the only answer, and if you want to see me go spiraling up through the ceiling, just be a patient of mine in the hospital having her baby who says, I think I'll stay for an extra day. When I've told them that medically they're okay to go home. And I say, well, gee, you know, that's awfully expensive. They say, that's all right, my insurance picks it up. Well, I don't know what your insurance policy has done, but I know what mine has done in the last 5 years. And when I went into practice 7 years ago, my insurance policy was running about $65 for a family of four. That same insurance policy has now gone up almost 100%. It's now 104 dollars, somewhere in that range, for a policy which has significant deductibles, and that's $104 a month. I'm not talking about a year. So that's why, that's part of the reason why hospital costs go up, is because it's not coming out of your pocket. And I think that would be one way to make that system better, is for your insurance company to pay you, and you have to write the check, you know. Now, a four-day hospital stay is going to run you, five-day hospital stay is going to run you in the neighborhood of between $1,200 and $1,500. And if you have to write $1,500 on that check and sign your name at the bottom, there's a whole different impact to that than there is to just walking out, seeing the hospital, and saying, "My gosh, that's high," you know. But if you had to write out the money, if it went into your checkbook and you saw the balance go up and then you saw the balance go down, there's a difference. And but be aware, that extra day that you spend in the hospital, instead of taking the time to get Joyce from down the street to come down and be around during that day, that first day when you're home, or by going down and, I don't know, in your town, whether you have Upjohn Company's got a homemaker service, it's professional, there are people who go in, and for $65 you can hire this lady to come in for 12 hours out of the day. But that's half of what it's going to cost you to stay in the hospital. And you've cut your health expenditures by half right there for that one day. And the lady, in the case of the lady having a baby, that's the lady in the hospital and the baby in the hospital. That's close to $250 a day. And you can hire the most competent nurse in the world to attend you to your every whim and wither at home for that kind of money. Well, why are hospital costs so high? Well, on the one hand, I'm proud to say that the janitor, we don't call them janitors anymore, I'm sorry, it's environmental services, they now make a living wage. And that means that somebody who's the primary support for their family, who does that kind of work in a hospital, now can make it without being on welfare too, or without having to lie about their income so that they get subsidized. That's true with a kitchen help, with nursing technicians, with nurses. They are now competing on a par with other equivalent kinds of professions outside of a hospital situation. The second thing is inflation hit us just like it's hit everybody else. And that is the fuel oil, whether that be the actual oil as it is in our particular community, or whether it's gas or electric heat. The lights, the phone, the food have all gone up for the hospital, the equivalent amount that it's gone up for the homeowner. People often talk about the disposables. They say, "Oh, gosh, you throw away so much." Well, what it is that the cost for the stuff to make the disposable plus the machine that makes it costs less than it costs to hire a person to wash it. And so actually it's a cost savings. The real culprit in hospital costs is the government. And that's, I know that it's fashionable to gripe about the government. I know that it's fashionable for doctors to gripe about the government. And yet that has some truth to it. That one aspect of it is just the simple aspect of red tape. And that is overwhelming in the hospital and adds $7, an average of $7 a day to your hospital bill, at least in my hospital, and my hospital has the lowest hospital day rate of any hospital in the state of Oregon. So they're doing a pretty good job, I think, from everything that I can see. But the records, the forms, the accounting, the documentation, the triplicate and however quintuplicate you say it, it has to go into the government, adds about $7 a day to your hospital bill. The other is a hidden tax on you, and I don't think people come out and tell you this. At one point, the AMA, and it still is, being very soundly chastised for being against Medicare and Medicaid. And those two have probably done more to increase the level of health in the older American population as well as the disadvantaged American population of any two things. But in doing so, they have discriminated against a segment of the society that is not discriminated against by the government in any other way. And that is that at the hospital, the government pays the bills for these two categories of people, but they only pay 60% of whatever the hospital charges. Now, the hospital doesn't run a large profit margin. The hospital bill is basically cut into what does it cost to put the hospital to run, and that includes the administrator's salary and all of that. And then, what are we going to put aside so that if we have a building program that we need to do, or renovation that we need to do, or upgrading of our equipment that we need to do, we have something to do that with? Those two things are what your hospital bill comprises. Well, the margin isn't very great, and 60% being paid doesn't meet the margin. So the hospital doesn't even meet its expenses when it's reimbursed at that level. So what the hospital then turns around and does is it takes the other people who pay and jacks theirs up so that it meets the other. So what's happening to you is you not only pay your taxes to the federal government that sets up the bureaucracy to manage the system and pays into the hospital, but you also are taxed in a hidden way because the hospital can't meet its expenses when it takes those people into the hospital, and so you're doubly taxed on that. And I think that, you know, if you feel like you want to be an activist in health, to direct your interests and your questions to your congressman about why they're only doing that is one way that we can help. We also have a problem in our area. We can't get elderly people that are sick enough to be required to be in a nursing home into nursing homes because the nursing home faces the same thing the hospital does, except the nursing home's population is almost 100% Medicare and welfare. And so the nursing home just doesn't have the beds for these people. They're scrapping as badly as they can, and that's a very difficult area to talk about. That's an area where we can really do some really neat health activist stuff, because a lot of people in nursing homes don't need to be. And that would make a big difference too, but we don't have the facilities to move them into some kind of sheltered care situation. Now, one of the reasons is the government doesn't pay for home health care. If we could pay for home health care, we'd be in great shape. I think that would be doing more to free up some neat, useful people and get them out of the nursing home right now sink. That's a terrible thing to be sent away and put in this place of dying people. Okay, physicians account for approximately 17% of all healthcare expenditures on an annual basis. That's not very much. And we're expensive, I think. I have some biases about it, but I'd like to offer you one reason that if you come to me and we'll have to do some bending of anatomy here a little bit, but assume you come to me as an obstetric patient, and I'm going to see you from the time that you get pregnant till 6 months after you've had your baby. I'll take care of you all during that time for not only the obstetric problems, but the colds, the flus, the urinary tract infections, the this, the that's that go on. That's all included in that, okay? And that includes your labor and your delivery. It may be that I'll be there when you deliver, and you'll go through your labor pretty much with a nursing staff keeping in touch with me. Maybe that's because I'm in my office during that period of time. Or I may be there at the hospital for the last 14 hours with you of your labor because it's different or complicated. Well, I bill $416 for that service. And this is where I may be a bad businessman, but my overhead runs 62%. So if you calculate that out, $270 of that is my overhead. And that means I make $146 to take care of a woman for 9+ months, as many visits as she needs in that pregnancy. And that means I may stay at the hospital all night or might not. And when I take care of a patient on Medicaid, that is a woman on welfare. Welfare pays me $235 to take care of her for that same period of time. I cannot charge any more. I cannot bill the patient. That's illegal. And so it costs me $25 out of my pocket to take care of that woman in her pregnancy. And I can tell you now that she will require more care than any single one of you in my office will. Her social problems are overwhelming. They're overwhelming, or she wouldn't be on welfare to begin with. And my resources to help take care of those are limited. So that's one thing. So when you come in and you're paying for your OB fee, I jack my OB fee up a little bit because I have to take care of those people. I take care of a fair number of people who can't afford to pay me. And the neat thing about a lot of those people is they'll say, "Doc, I can't afford your prices." And I say, "Fine, what can you afford?" And we negotiate a price, and I write off the rest of it. There are a very small minority of people who don't pay me at all and don't tell me they're not going to pay me. And they don't offer to barter either. I'm willing to barter, you know. If you do a boutique and you want me to take care of you for a year, and assuming that you don't have any severe health problems, but just your annual exam, any birth control problems that you may have, or vaginal discharges or whatever, breast lumps, do you want checked? And you want to make me a boutique for my office, I'm willing to negotiate that, and I'll provide care on that basis for you. But there are very few people who will barter with me about that.
Okay. Well, it's assigned in the office.
Right. Okay. Last year, I wrote off $15,000 worth of medical care. The next thing that the businessman said to me, "Well, gee, that's pretty good. You've got to write it off on your income tax, too." Well, it doesn't work that way. Medical care is a service. It's an intangible. And unless I can actually show that I had the money in my hand and I lost it in a business venture, I can't write it off. So that's a straight, flat-out loss to me in terms of what I charge. Well, I suppose in a way, I do increase my prices a little bit to compensate for that. I don't want my patients to pay for all of that. I don't think that's fair. What I am willing to do is to share in that with you as a patient of mine. So that if you see me and you're paying your bill, what you're doing is you're paying a little tiny bit for somebody who can't pay their bill. And I'm paying a little bit for that person who can't pay their bill too. I'm not going to zonk everybody with it. Well, then the last thing I want to do, and I'm sorry I'm running over, is to say, what do you think I ought to make an hour? What's a fair price for a doctor on an hourly wage? And it's been figured out from other people and stuff. Back in New York, there was a study and said that a doctor doesn't make any more than a plumber does. If the plumber worked the same number of hours that I worked, that he'd make the same that I do. Well, I don't know what a plumber makes because I guess I'm sheltered in what I do. I took some numbers and said $15 an hour. Is that too low? Plumbers make more than that?
I'd like to know what lawyers make.
What do lawyers make?
Do we have any lawyers here?
I don't know. Well, I took 15, and let's go through that, because if you want to make it 30 that you're going to pay me, just triple the last amount. And if you're going to make it 45 an hour you want to pay me, why, we'll just, I mean, yeah, we'll make it 30, double it. If we make it 45, we'll triple it. Well, I figure that I work 72 hours a week in what I do when I'm not at Holden. And that's why one of the reasons it's so nice to be at Holden. And at $15 an hour for a 40-hour week, that's $600. If I use borrow a little bit from the labor unions, and a lot of people seem to think that they're pretty fair to the people that are in the labor union at any rate, they tell them that they can have time and a half for overtime, not including weekends and holidays, which you get double time for. So I said that
approximately 20 hours of my time is overtime, and that's $450. That's on, it's on a weekly basis. And I've got about 12 hours of time that would average out to be a weekend or holiday under usual circumstances or average year circumstances. And that gives me $1,410 a week. Figure that I ought to get 2 weeks of vacation and 2 weeks of professional development time. That's not going to be the same as if I'm unionized, but because if I'm unionized, I'll get paid for that month that I'm out of the office. In my case, I don't get paid at all for that 1 month that I'm out of the office, because when I don't work, nothing comes in. So that means 48 weeks out of the year that I'm working, and that gives me an annual salary of $67,680. Well, you figure I've got to pay my overhead at 62%. That means that $41,961 of that goes for my overhead. And that means that I take home to my family $25,729. Is there anybody, an accountant here, who does income tax for people at the end of the year? Okay. Anybody have an income that's around about that they pay taxes on? Because I just took a ballpark figure and figured about 25% tax rate on that without a lot of deductibles. Well, I'll have to pay tax on that. I'll also have to pay my health insurance out of that. I also have to pay my disability, because if I get a broken leg or a broken, if I get a broken hand, I don't go into surgery, and I don't deliver babies, and that's my living. So I pay for my disability insurance, and then my retirement. Nobody pays into my retirement fund but me. And I figured that I'd pay 10% of my salary into my retirement fund. My health insurance on an average for a year for the four of us with some dental coverage thrown into that's $1,440. My disability insurance costs me $550. And my taxes will be $6,432. And that leaves me an income to live on of $10,872. And I left the piece of paper in the chalet lodge that said what that is on an annual or on a monthly salary, but it works out to be about $1,200. Anybody who owns a house knows that you can't make house payments for much less than about $300 a month on almost any house you buy now. So you can figure out what that leaves if you pay me $15 an hour. Now I'll tell you that I figure my time at $50 an hour. And I know some surgical colleagues of mine figure their time at somewhere around $79 to $82 per hour, and that's figured on surgical procedures. So that's part of where it is. That's where it goes. People say doctors drive Cadillacs. I don't know how many people have looked around.
I've looked around in Salem. I drive a Volkswagen.
And my wife drives a Volkswagen. We're somewhat frustrated with that, because the Volkswagen station wagon that we have is too small for a family of four with two kids now almost the size of adults. But I don't want to pay what they're asking for a dumb old car. So that's, you know, those are some of the issues. Maybe we can get a form going sometime in the evening. If you want to stop me and talk about some of these things or ask about stuff, I'll be glad to tell you what I can. Again, I'm sorry I didn't leave time for more questions. Yes?
I just wanted to interject. My husband's also a physician. And you can put in your annual fee of $500 for malpractice.
No, for disability.
For disability. I thought you had.
What about my malpractice? You don't want to know what I pay for malpractice.
You need to talk about
it. More, yeah, it's part of my overhead. That's why my overhead is 62%. Yes. I pay $15,000 a year.
Okay. My husband pays a little better than $5,000 a year.
What is
he used to be, he's an ophthalmologist and eye surgeon. But, you know, varying specialties, and I know your special is particularly high, but 5 years ago, his annual rate was $450, and today we pay $450 a month on malpractice.
So it's lots of expenses, but there's some rewards in medicine, too. I don't want to make it sound like it's downhill. scrape.